And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, June the 5th, 2018, 14 minutes past the hour. A very rainy Tuesday here in Ohio, that is to be sure. But we're having a good time, even though the rain is falling out time, and we've got a great program for you today. Now, I want to give you a little programming note. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to be joined by legendary actor James Caron. He will be with us tomorrow, 1:10 until 2 p.m., and you won't want to miss that. Then coming up on Thursday, we have some special guests that we are trying to line up that we will be announcing tomorrow, hopefully. So look for that. But today, a great program. In hour number two, we're going to be joined by one of our dear pals from the Daily Beast and the McLaughlin Group, Eleanor Clift, who is going to catch us up on everything that is going on in the world politically, from Supreme Court decisions to the president to who may be running for office this coming fall and maybe in the fall of 2020. But before we do that, we have a guest who I am always happy to have on. She is one of the funniest ladies in the world of show business. You probably remember her best from sitcoms like Night Court and Empty Nest. It's always a pleasure to welcome to these microphones to discuss topics of the day, Marcia Warfield. Marcia, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Doing well. Always good to talk with you. It's an interesting time in the world, to be sure. Would you not say?
Well, I can't think of a time that wasn't interesting, but we're hurtling on into the future, just pretty much like we did in the past.
You know, Marcia, I think about your career. You're back out doing stand-up comedy now. Is it different than it was in the 80s and 70s?
Well, different in some ways and the same in others. Well, one of the biggest differences, I would have to say, is technology. We simply didn't have the technology. We had three major networks. We had Showtime and HBO were still subscription services that were separate, that you had to have your own cable box. I mean, for each one or either one. They didn't run in the same market. We didn't have video playback capability. Nobody could record things on the street. We just didn't have the technology. So that shaped the whole landscape a little differently. But the issues really haven't changed.
It's interesting because I think about Kathy Griffin. I think about, I think it's been over 10 years ago now, but I think Michael Richards. And I think about people who were in private clubs, but because people had cell phones and recorded things they said, their careers suffered major hits. Is there a consciousness that that could happen now?
Well, that's always been. I mean, Lenny Bruce, they didn't have video recording back then, but for him to say things, they knew he was going to say, and then arrest him, and raid the place, and then arrest him. So there's always been a risk in saying what you want to say.
This is a tricky subject because obviously in the United States we do have free speech and nobody is going to be arrested, more than likely, for what they say.
Until now.
yeah, that's the thing. You never know. It's a different world, but employers do have the right, I guess, to fire people. I think about Michael Richards because we haven't heard much from him since he had that incident back in 2006. He was a hot property coming off Seinfeld, but that pretty well wrapped up his career. But Kathy Griffin making a comeback.
Yes, and if you read her her Twitter thread explaining where she's coming from, she makes a lot of sense. Whether you agree with her politics or whatever, her position is that the president, the government, shouldn't be interfering in and weighing in on whether she should work or not because of what she says. And that makes a lot of sense.
Obviously, a lot of jokes are made about President Trump. And when President Clinton was in office, since he's back in the news, I remember a lot of jokes being made about President Clinton. Are there places, though, even a comedian can't go with high politicians?
No. There are no subjects that are off limits. There's, some people are more deft at approaching them, you know, and dealing with them than others, but nothing's off limits.
Is there a difference between going to see a Marsha Warfield show in 2018 than there would have been in the 80s? Are you more political now, less political?
I don't know if I'm more or less political. I'm a whole different person in that Marsha Warfield in the 80s and 90s was closeted gay woman who was dealing with all of that and come in that environment dealing with issues of dating and stuff like that, or skirting around those issues, and now I'm out and I'm dealing with the world that I'm presented with now. So sure, there's probably a difference. The attitudes are going to be the same. I'm still, tilting the windmills, but
it's interesting when you talk about that, about coming out. Ellen said that she felt that there was pressure for her not to do that until she did it. Rosie O'Donnell said she thought people knew, even though she hadn't said it. When you were on Night Court, when you were on Empty Nest, and those were hit shows on network television and had huge audiences, were you told not to talk about that?
No, never. I mean, I never said anything to the cast and crew. They never said anything to me. I never hid anything, whoever I was dating. We weren't, swapping spit on set. But they were around just like everybody else. It just was, the world was don't ask, don't tell before there was a don't ask, don't tell. And so those open secrets have always been, and they were just things you don't talk about.
Were you surprised that it stayed a secret for so long?
No, because I don't know if it was a secret. It's like, it's a very strange thing, especially at my age, growing up at a time when it wasn't talked about, when it was discouraged, when parents would see things in their children and smack their hands for them, so you don't want to wear those jeans kind of mentality. And then growing up into how things have evolved and how I had to come into my own consciousness. It's not as clear as people want to make it. We have a soundbite mentality now because of technology, and we think very linearly. A equals B equals C equals D. Well, it doesn't. Sometimes A equals X, and you have to go all around the alphabet to get back to where you started. So, it's an interesting time to be who I am now, to know things I know and to have enough sense to know I don't know what's coming in the future.
It's interesting, Marsha, because I remember we did an interview because for a long time, after Empty Nest and a few other roles, you kind of went off the grid totally as far as acting, stand-up comedy, taking roles went, and then you decided to come back, and you're back in stand-up comedy now doing shows. In the world of reboots, would you like to be back on a sitcom?
Yes, and in fact, I'm working on writing one at the moment, like everybody else in show business. But yes, that's something that I love television. I love television more than film, almost as much as stand-up. And so I'd love to be on TV.
Can you give us a little hint as to what is coming?
Well, it's about a black woman.
I thought maybe.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a stretch, but I think I'm up to it.
Well, I know people would love to see that. Have you been approached about guest starring on shows since you came back to performing?
I live in Vegas, you know, so being in Vegas, it's close, but not that close. So I'm not in the L.A. television market. So, no, that doesn't happen as much. It's been pretty much focused on stand-up.
I want to talk just briefly about this, but the big news last week was the Roseanne series was canceled. But I do hear rumblings now that it may come back without Roseanne. We know what Roseanne said. We don't have to say it again. But do you think that was the right decision?
For who? Roseanne or for ABC?
For the network. Should they have done
it? Oh, okay. I mean, it's like, should she have said it, and should it have resulted in the actions that were taken? You know, this is a pattern. She's always pushed the envelope, and sometimes the envelope pushes back. And that's just the reality that every comedian faces, everybody who speaks publicly. You never know when or what you say that you've gotten away with before is going to hit people the wrong way. So, you know, everybody from Tracy Morgan to, like you said, Michael Richards and Kathy Griffin and Whoopi have all had those moments where you suffer from saying what you say. But you got to know that going in. So I don't know that there were any surprises other than she's gotten away with it before. Now she's not.
Yeah, it certainly is an interesting take. Since we talked last, sad event, Harry Anderson, who I think the world loved, Judge Stone on Night Court, and Harry the Hat on Cheers, and all the appearances on Saturday Night Live, passed away rather young in his 60s. What was Harry Anderson like to work with?
Oh, Harry was a sweetheart. He was, he was a lot like both Harry the Hat and Judge Stone. I think he was more Harry the Hat, though. He had a very wicked sense of humor, and but he had a heart big as, you know, all outdoors. The tribute to him was very moving and touching and funny, and more of a celebration than a funeral, you know. It was a chance to, you know, get together and wear our hats in his honor.
Absolutely. Night Court went off the air in 1992. Had you stayed in touch with Harry at all?
We only talked a couple of times in that, you know, span. Everybody after the show went on to different, you know, pursuits in different parts of the country, you know, and did their own thing. So it's rare that we cross paths. But as far as I know, you know, everything was friendly. It was a reunion at his memorial. And, you know, it's still a family. You don't have to see family every day to still have that connection.
When you heard the news of his passing so young, is it hard to deal with?
Oh, I tried to announce it on Facebook and ended up in tears. So, yeah, I mean, I had no clue I was going to break up like that. It just, you know, it hit you like a ton of bricks. Harry and I were the two youngest cast members. And we lost, in fact, that's how I got on the show. The cast lost two bailiffs before me. So there were always, there was always loss and tragedy, but this one hit hard. It came out of nowhere. And I know his family, it hit them hard, but they put on the perfect Harry tribute, and it was an honor to be there.
What was the memorial service like?
Let's laugh, have some drinks, and remember our friend. You know, it was probably one of the best ways to do it. There was, not a lot of maudlin stuff, which is not to say there weren't a lot of tears. You know, there were tears, but it was bittersweet.
Harry had, I believe, moved to New Orleans, and then went after Hurricane Katrina had left there. Had he been ill? Did anybody, or was this just totally out of the blue?
I don't know, and I really haven't, gotten into. I know they said he had a stroke and had a flu or something recently, prior to that. But as far as what other, contributing factors there are, I have no clue.
What's your favorite Harry Anderson memory?
Favorite? I don't know. We had a lot of, we used to kid around a lot. We did, we all did a lot of game show appearances and stuff, and we all loved little word games and stuff. So we would, amuse ourselves on the set, making up password clues and trying to stump each other and pyramid type game things, and we just had a lot of fun between takes. Harry was the first one to out to me when I first got on the show, because I felt, intimidated as a stand-up among all these actors, and at that time the show was getting a lot of recognition. John was being nominated for Emmys, Harry was being nominated for Emmys, and I'm walking into the show as a stand-up, and Harry called me over to the bench and said, "Don't worry about it, I'm not an actor either," and he made me feel like it was okay, and from then on it was no problem, and he treated me and everybody else treated me.
That's great to hear. He certainly will be missed. It's an interesting time because Bill Cosby is awaiting sentencing, possible minimum of 10 years in prison, maximum of 30 years in prison. And on Facebook, you had talked after Bill Cosby was sentenced about your run-ins with Bill Cosby over the years. Talk a little bit about the Bill Cosby of the 1980s when you first became aware of him personally.
Oh, personally. I mean, I've always been aware of him as, Bill Cosby was a fact of life my whole life. I remember as a kid watching, sneaking up late at night and watching Playboy After Dark and seeing him on Ed Sullivan every week and all of his shows that he had before the Cosby Show that were all named some kind of Cosby Show. He had a variety show named Cos. He had the Bill Cosby Show where he played Chet Kincaid. He had, that's all. Sci-fi, of course. I always knew who Bill Cosby was and always admired him as a comedian, as a person. I mean, the things he did, he stood for, you had to admire and love Bill Cosby. So when the rumors came about in the press, I wasn't shocked because I had heard about from someone else that that was a possibility, and any of the things he was accused of were a possibility, and that was a shock and a hard to accept piece of information.
Knowing that this is where he is headed, they say before July, is that do you feel justice has been served, in your opinion?
That's not really something I can answer. I'm not one of those women who were personally affected. They've answered that. You know, those of us who sit on the outside, we can talk about it, but we're basically helpless. Our hands are tied. There's nothing we can contribute one way or the other. And so whether justice has been served, you know, I don't know. I don't know what justice situation. I defer to the victims.
When this all happened, when he was found guilty, knowing what you had known, what you were told about Mr. Cosby, did you ever think he would be found guilty in your own mind?
You know, I watch a lot of trials. I used to watch when court TV was a thing. You know, I used to watch a lot of them. You never know what's going to happen with jury trial. You know, there are so many variables, so many moving parts to a trial. It always could go either way. And, you know, so I don't know if I'm surprised. I don't know if I'm sad. I mean, I don't even know if I have the right to have an opinion because, you know, I'm not personally affected. And I'm just feel bad that any of it is something we have to talk about or not are required to talk about. Yeah, to discuss. It just is sad all around. And like I said, I feel sorry for the victims. Even if you consider Mr. Cosby a victim, I feel bad for him too, whatever he faces. I know it's not easy for a man his age and a man who has accomplished all he has. So, but the jury has spoken. He had his day in court, and
It's interesting because when the guilty verdict came down, a lot of people reflected back to the 80s and said, and it was true, at one point this man was second only in popularity to the Pope at one point, likability. With Bill Cosby, there seemed to be no negative. He wasn't that political. He didn't use profanity when he did nightclub performances. Boy, it's just 180 degrees from the guy we thought we all knew. What impact do you think it has on his legacy, Cosby Show, being the clean comedian, being the second most popular man in television? He was America's father.
Well, I think we need to examine what our values are. What is, you know, what's the virtue of being clean if you're doing things that are terrible? You know, I mean, we have very skewed values, I believe. And all of that contributes to the situations that a lot of the earlier ones we talked about, too. What is really important? As opposed to what we've made seem important. He says a curse word now and again. If they're, you know, fighting for justice and helping out the homeless and, you know, campaigning for environmental causes, so they say a dirty word, whereas somebody else who never speaks a terrible, bad, one of the seven dirty words, is out, you know, beating up people on the street. You know, we have to really assess what is important. And seems in this case, the image of a good, clean family man is not really as important as being a good person, in the scheme of things.
It's very interesting because when the guilty verdict came down, as you said, you had talked about in the 80s hearing about these things he might be doing or have done, not witnessing them, but hearing about them. People did say it had happened. Guest stars on The Cosby Show had said it had happened. Why do you think it stayed silent for so long? Do you think it would have made any difference if you had said anything?
Well, if I had said anything, I have no idea who I would have said it to. Or first of all, do I believe it? You know, I only heard it once from one person and in a vacuum. And to like, well, is this true? You know, where do I go to find confirmation? And why would I, you know? And if you say, I wish I hadn't been told. And you kind of just try to let it go. But then when it comes back, you know, 10, 20 years later, then you go, oh, you know, I guess it was true. So I don't know if third-hand information from one person would have made a difference or how it could have. But along those lines, Hannibal Buress credit, as a comedian, as a person, for having the guts to go there and just put it out there. You know, very few people would have done that.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see what has happened the last few years, I think 4 years since this all came about. The day he was found guilty, you wrote a Facebook post and a lot of people picked up on it. Why did you feel that that was the time to write that?
He had had his day in court. There was, again, it would have any impact, hearsay or otherwise, on anybody's opinion that would matter in court. And so I felt like, well, this is what I knew, or what I thought I knew, or what I had heard, and just put it out there, you know, because it had been eating at me through this whole process. And again, what do you do? Where do you go? What do you say? What does it mean?
Yeah.
What if I had written that the trial was going on? You know, do you really want to have that out in the air when people are supposed to be deliberating on the facts and not on hearsay and gossip? So, but once that had been done, I felt like I could, you know, put that out there. And it wasn't easy, you know, it wasn't an easy decision to make. And it was one of those close your eyes and push in things. And that's what I did. And all where they may.
Yeah. This leads, the last 15 minutes of the interview here, leads us into, I think, an interesting discussion, which I've had with some other stand-up comics. You worked with Richard Pryor. He obviously had some issues in his life. We certainly know what Bill Cosby's are now. There are others, Robin Williams, suicide. Is there some Roseanne certainly comes to the forefront in recent days. Is there some correlation with stand-up comics? Is it there has to be some pain behind that? There has to be something behind. George Carlin comes to mind with drug abuse. Is that understandable?
Well, only in that we're human beings. I mean, I think something we all are dealing with. We have our images and we have our reality, and somehow, in a lot of people's lives, they don't mesh. They don't match. I would like for my image and reality to be almost seamless. You know, what you see is what you get, flaws and all. But that doesn't something we promote. We don't tolerate humanity in our I can't say heroes, but in our public figures, whether they're politicians or religious people or comedians or who knows, we just don't tolerate humanity, and so everything becomes a negative, and we end up, you know, weighing, you know, it's just the real person as opposed to the image. Well, we should be a little more open to letting people be people. And just because somebody might have, like you said, just because a president cusses, that doesn't mean he's not a good president. You know, it just, but we will judge them harshly, far too harshly for things like that. And so we when presented with people's humanities and flaws, we make it more of a tragedy because it doesn't match our manufactured image. I think we need to, you know, get more raw about that, where people tend to be a little more, you know, close to their their image.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because the comparison is fascinating, because if people in your own community who were not famous were doing this, it would be an issue, but it would be affecting them and the people who they were involved with. When you take people like Bill Cosby and Roseanne, their reruns have been pulled. People don't want to air their things anymore. There are other people in those casts who that affects residual-wise. Should it affect the work? Should the work and the person be separate?
I don't know how you do that. I don't know, you know, how you do that. If we're all dealing with this kind of thing. Well, as if it's new, but it's not. People are always going to be people, and they're always going to do things fairly like this, but there's going to be, you know, famous trials. There's going to be the Fatty Arbuckles. There's going to be scandals, and there always have been. So I don't know how you handle that. I don't know the last time I saw movie. So weren't they doing this? Have they been doing this forever?
it has gone on for a while. That is certainly true. When you hit big on Night Court, and you were given your own talk show, syndicated talk show, what was that period like? Few people experienced that. Everybody knew who you were.
It was a network talk show. It was an NBC show.
But oh, that's right. Yes, that's right. NBC.
But at the time, it was just, you know, you take advantage of the opportunity to come along if you can. I was working working so much that it was just about getting to work. You know, I would do the Night Court Monday through Friday, and then hit the road and do stand up on the weekends, and then shoot or if I wasn't doing stand up, I'd do game shows, and when I got my talk show, shoot the talk show. So, you know, it was just about having the opportunity to do all the things I had ever dreamed about, and try to make them work. You know, sobering and humbling when it didn't work, because I had been riding such a wave of success to that point, but I was just trying to, you know, do all the things I'd ever dreamed about.
When you get on a sitcom like Night Court, and people recognize you, they watch you every week, they love you, the bookings go up, I imagine, in the comedy clubs because of it, you get a talk show, and then a show like that goes away, do people see you a certain way when they call for you? Are there parts you can't get because of being recognized from those series?
Well, not that I know of. I don't you know, I would never know if they said, don't call Marsha Warfield because she's been on Night Court. You go. You know, as an actor, an actress, you end up on auditions with the same people all the time anyway. Because the parts call for types, you know, and you always end up on the same auditions with the same people. So that didn't change. There just, at that time, started to be more opportunities than there had been. But not just because I had been on Night Court, but because there were just more opportunities for black actors and black women at that time that were opening up than had been before the 80s and 90s.
At different, I would say you knew Richard Pryor certainly better than Bill Cosby or Roseanne or any of these other situations we're talking about. What do you think were, just from a perspective of knowing the man, what were Richard Pryor's, we saw him play out in the public, but what were his demons, do you think?
I have no clue. Yeah. I don't know. I never lived with the man. I have no idea what his angels or, you know, I knew as a performer, as a comedian, he was probably the best that ever did it. He just had so many skills, and for somebody coming along at the time I did, he might as well have been God, the comedy God that I worshiped. And so whatever drove him, whatever made him, whatever he is, I didn't ever come into my consciousness because he's Richard Pryor. I mean, Richard Pryor.
Looking at his stand-up comedy, because everybody pretty well has the consensus that he was the best, what made him the best?
He could do everything, and he did it so seamlessly. He made it seem like, you know, he was just having a conversation with people, but then would just all of the comedy tools and all of the comedy techniques, he just wove seamlessly into these magical shows. Hello?
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, when we talk about fame and what it does or does not do, it's very interesting because the people who are in the news now, we think about, if it weren't Bill Cosby, if it weren't somebody who was a mega TV star, would these women have come to his room? Well, of course we don't know the answer, but probably unlikely. If Roseanne was not the number three show on television, would anybody care what she's tweeting? So does fame, I guess in some ways, fame does drive that problem. In some sorts, I guess. Did you ever have an ego? Because I hear I hear a lot of that with Bill Cosby, that he was smiling in court, that he had an ego that he would never get caught.
Well, everybody has an ego. I mean, that's what makes you decide to stand up in front of strangers and tell them your opinion about stuff that, you know, interests you. We all have an ego. That's the Martin Luther King drum major instinct. So I don't know that having an ego is a negative thing. I don't know that people who aren't famous don't face the same kind of consequences. You know, you say the wrong thing on your job, you can get fired too. We're seeing a lot of now with body cam footage and stuff, things that people used to get away with. They're not getting away with anymore. And people are losing. They are far from famous. In fact, the only thing they're famous for is now they're losing their job. So I don't know that anybody can get away nowadays with being less than a good person.
when you go up on stage now, as opposed to when you first were getting up on stage, people know now this is Marsha Warfield. Does that give you any edge when you get up on stage that people know your body of work?
No, not really, because people have their opinions based on what they know. So if they know Roz, they think Roz, Empty Nest, they think Maxine Douglas. If they know, you know, the prior show, they think whatever. It's not like people, and then I took 15, 16 years off. So there's a whole generation there, more than one generation of people have no clue. So every audience is different. Every show is different. And we all have to start out introducing ourselves to these nice strangers who gathered together to let us talk to them. So no, I don't think people have any idea that.
When you get up on stage today, is it as nerve-wracking as it used to? Do you still have stage fright?
Yes. You have to have stage fright or you shouldn't be doing it.
How do you
I mean, stage fright is basically your body getting ready and excited and, you know, nervous. I mean, it's not debilitating. But, yeah, every show, because you never know what's going to happen. You know, there are no guarantees. And when you get to the point where you're smug about your own performance, you probably should take a rest.
Are you constantly writing and thinking funny?
I am, yes. Yes, I write all the time. And sometimes it's Facebook posts. It's tweets, it's this, and in between that, there'll be a bit I'll come up with or start writing on a sitcom or, you know, idea. Always, sure.
You took 16 years off. Was there a time when it was not fun? Not fun to be Marsha Warfield?
Yeah, always. But probably about 20 minutes ago, but yeah.
I hope that's not true.
Well, you know, it's life. We, you know, there is no charmed perfect. There are no perfect people. We, you know, everybody gets, you know, the flu every once in a while. And there are times when you just feel blah. Sometimes when you feel scared and defeated and lonesome. And I mean, that's just being a people. And so I hope I never lose that, you know. Again, when you start believing your own press and start thinking that you might actually be able to walk on water, you know, you go out and try it, and the results are pretty stark wake-up call. So I hope I never have to go through that.
When people come up to you today, what's their reaction? What do they say? What do they recall?
Usually it's something like, excuse me, could you get out of my way? They have no clue, you know, or you look like somebody I think I knew in high school, you know. I took 15 years off, then, you know.
Well, do you regret that 15 years off?
No. No, and it makes it this time very exciting. Again, I had to start all over again. I went back to the basics of beginning, to bar shows, to working wherever, whenever I could get any kind of stage time, and building the act from the ground up, just like I did as a rookie, you know, in 1974. So I became a rookie again, and I'm just now at the point where I feel confident that the work I've put in is good work, and I'm ready to present the product to the people.
There was always this discussion about regional work that things will work in California, and they'll work in Las Vegas, and they'll work in New York, but they won't work in Indiana? Is funny just funny? Which way is it?
I don't buy into the regional. I don't buy into all of the hyper-partisan hype that, you know, I people are people, and even in the reddest state, there are blue people and vice versa. And even some of the most hyper-partisan people have some beliefs that don't fit. We don't fit into neat little boxes, and people are not just caricatures and stereotypes. And so I try not to play to those made-up preconceived notions that people have. You give me an audience, and you like it or you don't. You know, it, even the best show, even the very best show that any comedian ever did, there's going to be 5, 10, 20% didn't enjoy it at all. They just didn't like it. So,
one question I want to get to here before we part ways. The thing yesterday with the Supreme Court, it's complicated, but the man in Colorado does not have to bake the cake for the same-sex couple. When you heard that decision, will that be in the performance? Will that be in the act? Is that comedy? But is there also a serious part, being somebody who is in same-sex relationships?
Well, I haven't really, you know, made the joke for the act. You know, I have opinions about it, and but at this point, it's not my my focus. I'm as a person, I think you know, it has. Well, it's a long story. Make the frickin' cake and shut up. You know, it has nothing to do with your religious beliefs, and let people live. You know,
go ahead.
No, that was about it. I just think you know, we here again, we get spikes, but legal definitions and legal opinions are kind of complex, and we have to deal with the context, and nobody contextualizes anything anymore. So it's the right and wrong and bang the table kind of thing, because that feels good. But the bottom line is, there's no harm to anyone by making a cake for someone who wants to celebrate an important event in their life.
Well, there's one thing that is still for sure in this world, that Marsha Warfield is funny. So if she is in your area, you will want to see her, and that she is always a great, great guest. Marsha, it's always a pleasure to have you on. I hope you keep coming back. And boy, I think we all look forward to hopefully seeing that sitcom on television one day.
Well, thank you so much for asking me, and keep asking me. I'll always be here.
Hey, thank you, Marsha.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Marsha Warfield, one of a kind. We're going to break, coming back with Eleanor Clift right after this.
Number 740-225.